Could we make a start? Can I start off by making a request of you all? Last time Amitai Tsioni was here in London, he had to speak to an audience of about 800, so I wasn't able to have a proper discussion with them. The purpose of this evening's event is very much for not to have a monologue, but a dialogue. So the more of you could actually move forward and fill these empty spaces, the better, I think, in terms of giving us a feel of a discussion rather than a lecture. So many sort of role models, community leaders at the back could start a stampede downwards.
Make a deal with you. First of all, you won't be able to hear me up there. Second, if you sit here and you need to leave in the middle, just get up and no offense taken, but if you stay up there, I'll be terribly offended. Let me see that. Yeah, that's convince you? I'm even less effective than I thought I am. I don't bite, I don't spit. Come on.
Okay, well, I suggest we make a start if that's as much much movement, popular movement as we can manage this evening. Perhaps something Amitai says will spur you into a more genuine repositioning, but we'll have to wait and see. Can I just introduce myself and Amitai? I'm Jeff Mulgan from Demos, and this is Amitai Tsioni, who is currently having a mini sabbatical at the LSE. And Amitai, I think many of you, I'm sure, will have read his work and know about him. I think he's quite rare, and some people don't quite realise just how much he did in a sort of incarnation as an academic in sociology, and then I think particularly through the book The Moral Dimension, which has helped create an academic movement in the Society of the Advancement of Socioeconomics, and bringing some much needed reality and indeed morality into economics, which often feels uneasy with that. And perhaps he's best known, though, for his sort of move after that with the foundation of the Communitarian Network and the book The Spirit of Community, which has had quite a big influence in a lot of countries, certainly in the US, where he's had an influence on both sides of the political spectrum. In quite a few European countries, and particularly Germany, there's a lot of interest in communitarian ideas. And here in Britain, senior politicians from at least three parties I know have both met him and talked about these ideas and their relevance. He's just published this book, The New Golden Rule, which is sitting there, and he's going to talk for a few minutes about some of the ideas in that. I hope we're then going to have a chance for a real conversation rather than just a question and answers about some of the issues in there and about some of the specific policy matters which perhaps come out of it on everything from inequality to childcare. That's all I will say. We're going to end at 6:30, and I believe the bookshop is now not open until 7 for you to buy your copies, so you'll have to buy them here. Amitai, over to you.
Thank you very much. This is my face, so how can I... Yeah, okay. I thought it looked like a microphone. Oh, that's a microphone. Now, in all seriousness, can you hear me up there?
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for a very generous introduction. At least 50% of the success of communitarian thinking in Europe is due to Jeff here, who helped introduce us to these shores, and as you know, he's now working part of the time for Downing Street, so the communitarian ideas are sound and safe in his hands, I'm sure. And I also must thank to Selena Conan, a kind of new friend who made all this possible. Much thanks. I mean what I say. I would very much like to have a conversation and not just question and answers. But I'll say a few things about communitarian thinking, just to get the conversation rolling. But unlike the book and unlike the public lecture the other day, rather than covering the waterfront and giving you a brief visit about all the major pieces, I'd like to focus on one issue, and that is, how does a community, a society, change its directions, change its mind, do things differently in a big way? I'm not talking about the margin, I'm not talking about rearranging the chairs, but about profoundly changing direction. Now, to get there, let me start with the definition of community. Many people have argued that there's a term which is terribly vague and elusive. There's a professor of political science who written a book called The Dance with Community, in which he showed that there are 50 or 60 more definitions. Now two of them match the other, and he basically closed his book on a despair that this term will be ever defined. Now, for our purposes, I'd like to suggest that communities have two defining attributes. One is that people bond with each other, that they have affective relationships to one another. And second, that a community has a shared culture. And culture, I don't mean here as art and music, but as a shared set of values, a shared set of moral understandings. That the importance of that is that there's an underlying psychological and sociological assumption here, which many of you, including me, will not like. But the subject is not, at the moment, what we like. It's a question, is that a correct description of human nature? And the underlying kingpin here is that, that people do need each other's approval. Now, there are some people, or usually we refer to them as psychopaths, who can guide themselves, and they pay little or no mind to others. But the rest of us are very profoundly affected by what other people, not randomly necessarily, sometimes we call them significant others or close ones, including the members of the community, a hold of us. So if a community holds that, well, to give a trivial example, so to make it quicker, I used to live in one of those fancy suburbs, and being somewhat of a professor, I didn't mow my lawn. And it flowered and grew and spread the seeds on the neighbors. And it got very, very upset with me. And so they came first to talk to me gently, and then I paid no mind, I didn't quite understand, and then it became very clear. That community said very strongly that a moral, that a shared understanding, that you kept your garden neat. And if not, they're going to various ways, but they displeased or not. They wouldn't throw tomatoes at me. But they wouldn't watch for my car, they wouldn't loan me a cup of sugar. And in the end, I had a choice to make. I could either go along or leave or be isolated. Now, the same community, it was not a fit subject for discussion if children were driving 100 miles an hour in sports cars in a zone which was to be 25 miles an hour. So communities may not have the values which I would choose or you would choose, but they have set of values, and they have a particular interesting instrument of enforcing them. They're making each other either praise people, appreciate, when they follow what the community thinks is what they should behave, or they chide them and criticize them when they don't. Why is this so important? And that gets me for a moment to the subject of the book, The New Golden Rule. If we look about the Golden Rule, not on a personal level, but on a social level, there is a tension between the society's need to foster certain common good. If it's attention to the environment or to the poor or to defense or whatever the society is of mind need attending. And the desire of most members to be left alone and follow their own pursuits. And somehow the tension, the new Golden Rule suggests that we have to find a middle course in which we, on the one hand, will attend to the common good, on the other hand, not violate people's desire to make their own choices. And there are really, in the end, three ways of dealing with that. One is to force people to do what needs doing. And it's what the government often does. Second is to pay people to do what's need doing, which the marketplace does. But and when you come to the common good, it's often impractical to pay everybody to be good friends, to be good parents, to be not to abuse their spouses. And second, but oddly and technically, when people do things because they're paid to do things, they still don't want to do them. I mean, for those of you who study, they do not change their preference. They just yield because they want to be paid off. The only way we can get people to change their preferences is if we convince them. Convince them of the merit of what needs doing. So when we talk about communities struggling with issues, and you pick the issue, if you want to reduce inequality, or I'm talking about big time issues, not the minor issues. You want to deal with crime, you want to significantly increase foreign aid. In the end, it comes down to having a moral dialogue, often messy and complicated, out of which a new shared understanding arises. And when you do it any other way, you build resistance and ultimately defeat your purpose. Now, I'm going to repeat here quickly an example I gave the other evening, because I think it's useful to have something concrete to look at. We did, again, I'm not going to take something very complicated like inequality. I'm going to take something much more delineated to save time. The United States dealt with two issues, one the wrong way and one the right way, right, not morally speaking now, but technically speaking. We had a prohibition. Prohibition, somebody pushed through, or in this case, a constitutional amendment, making the consumption and production of alcohol illegal. The overwhelming majority of the society did not accept it as morally acceptable. And the result was an enormous corruption. There is some debate if it slightly did reduce the amount of drinking or not, but there is no question, I think, in anybody's mind, the results were extremely undesirable, somewhat like we have in our war against drugs now. The judges, police, whole subversive industry. And the constitutional amendment was repealed and we went back to legal drinking. Over the last 25 years, we had a debate about public smoking. 25 years. And again, I don't want to go into detail, but then we passed some laws recently prohibiting smoking in most public places when there was a successful conclusion to dialogue. And there was barely a peak. You go to up and down the United States and you will see people voluntarily complying with the law. So let me emphasize this last point. Often when I have this discussion, people say, but some things need to be done by law. The key distinction here is between laws which are backed by morality, backed by a new shared understanding. Indeed, they are necessary. They give the enclosure and underwriting, they deal with the small group of people who don't want to come along, who will undermine their understanding if they will not do their share. And laws which are not backed by a moral understanding. There is a world of difference between those which are backed up or not. And let me be very, very concrete, and let me close here and see if we can have a discussion on this one issue. How the society is changing in a big way, what role does moral understandings play and expression of law as against simply phantom legislation. When you want to look what's going to happen here over the next 4 years, let me make some predictions. Some of the things which a new government does are based on previous accumulation of moral understandings, of pent-up demand almost, the very economists would say. The things which were done in over the last 18 years antagonized large parts of the public, and when they're now corrected or the society moves in another direction, they are very much supported by large segments of the public. Other things are technical, of what the overwhelming majority of the public couldn't care less, doesn't even know what exactly mean, who's going to set interest rates, is it the bank or somebody else? But if the new government will strike out a major direction for which the government has not been prepared, and will continue to do so on a large scale, you see exactly an example of what I mean, where you're going to have resistance and ultimate inability to implement the law. Therefore, it's essential in my judgment that in those areas in which there is no build-up consensus, that additional steps should be taken to deepen and broaden the mandate. Well, let me see if that provokes some discussion. If not, I'll say some other things more provocative.
Would anyone like to respond to that? Anyone else in a sense? Even in the last few weeks, we've seen a range of issues which perhaps test that. Negative ones around guns, hunting, positive ones, parent school contracts, joining mentoring schemes, all these different ways in which governments try to persuade people to do things differently, perhaps alongside or ahead of legislation. You and you. Could you just, before you speak, say who you are?
Yes, Sarah Ludford.
And could you stand up and speak up, because people back can't hear you.
My name is Sarah Ludford. I'm here in an individual capacity, but I happen to be vice chair of the Liberal Democrats Policy Committee. I'm not sure I've addressed precisely the question that's been put, because it's my first chance to hear Professor Etzioni, and I'm delighted to have the chance. I'm sympathetic to some of what you say, but I noticed in your introductory remarks you talked about a balance between what I take to be sort of original communitarian ideas and the tensions between that and people's right to do their own thing, what I would call the right to be different. And I'm not sure, I mean, I would love to hear a little bit more from you about how you ensure that. I mean, I liked your anecdote, rather cosy anecdote about your cup of sugar. But, I mean, we can think of some very much less cosy situations where people could risk being coerced. And I'm not sure that one can take your predictions of laws backed by morality and shared understanding so far that it copes with the rights of minorities. Let's think of perhaps a situation in the police. I mean, it's quite mainstream, and one doesn't have to be way out to know that there is a great problem in the police for women and ethnic minorities. There, your shared culture is a white male culture which doesn't like people being different. How do you cope with that? How do you create your shared culture without a very strong enforceable law against discrimination?
I think it's good to respond to that actually now, because there's a strong tradition of using law to change cultures rather than the other way around, particularly perhaps in the United States.
It is a good way to get us into discussion. I think we need. You referred to original communitarian ideas, and I need to clear up that a little before I get to the main point.
The ones I'm suspicious of.
Well, we share that one for sure. Unfortunately, it's not a registered term, and so people use it. There are people in Singapore who call themselves communitarians, and all kind of other people. Before that shocks you too much, let me remind you that the term socialism has been used by all kind of people, including some people who call themselves national socialists. And if you take any other term, unfortunately, and I mean it seriously, they are not protectable. People talk about religion, Christianity, have used all kind of banners and all. So the communitarianism I talk about is not communities over here and individuals over here, but a good community does balance its concern for the common good and for the individual's rights and responsibilities. We said from day one, require one another. But about this specific issue, constitutional democracy, sociologically translated, answers the issue you're correctly concerned about. And it says, aside from each community having its own shared understandings, we have a shared understandings on the next level in a society. I'll come to a still higher level in 1 minute. And we basically say to each other that we have certain rules by which we play, and each community is free to do what it comes to understand as long as it doesn't violate. We sometimes use for shorthand the Constitution. But the Constitution really stands for a set of shared values. But we put them in a special box and we say they are not subject to majority rule. So, for instance, we feel that the right to free speech, we don't feel, we put our hand on a stack of Bibles and swore that the right to free speech is not negotiable. And a community cannot decide that, well, no, we don't like that, we're going to do something different. And no community can deny you the right to vote, et cetera, et cetera. And all the other issues, we say, how much you want to tax people locally, if you want to open the schools for more, there's a whole other bunch of things you say, you work it out, community, we're not going to interfere. Now, I find that a rather satisfactory solution. It solves all the issues you raised with one catch. That is, you're entitled, and I think we should ask the same questions about the next level. And we come, for instance, we look at the American Constitution, and there is no mentioning of socioeconomic rights, which the German Constitution, for instance, has. And some people go to the next level and say there's something called United Nations Declaration of Rights, and they try to use this as a criteria. And there it gets difficult because these values are not as well ensconced and legitimated because there was no moral conversation worldwide like we had when we formed our framing values. But in short, the tension exists between local communities and a larger society, but I believe it's a not only workable solution, but a solution most times. There are always things at the margin we have to struggle with. It gets us to the right results. It will protect minorities. It will protect the right of women. Or if it's not, it will lead to a struggle. But the terminology, the frame of reference will be clear. We'll bring in the societal institutions to protect people within communities.
Could we take you and then you in order to ask the question? And it says that there's the other strand, I think, in your question, which is really how comfortable we feel about praise and blame being part of public policy, whether we think policy should be neutral and in a sense shorn of those things. Do you want to ask a question?
Jeff Goldberg, Prenfield University. I was just...
Can everybody hear you at the back?
Okay. I'm Jeff Goldberg, Prenfield University. My query was, I detected in some of what you were talking about, and in just flipping through some of your writing, which I have not studied very carefully, feeling that you're moving away from the notion of procedural justice. Yeah, okay, you see that it, enthusiastic support for that, which comes through in sort of two strands. One is exactly the notion of saying, in your example about not cutting the lawn, but also in a lot of your writing, disdain for what you call deliberative rationality. I'm just wondering if that's really a good idea to move away from procedural justice. The idea that if people accept a system by which the rules are made, and if that is accepted as legitimate, then that also legitimizes the rules themselves. And I find that a very, very attractive notion, and one that I would think should be encouraged. And I'm wary of moving away from that.
Can you just answer your own question, say, in relation to alcohol?
No, it's a wonderful discussion. It's a wonderful discussion because you do exactly what I mean. When you talk about neutral policy or the fear of praise and especially criticism, well, it would be wonderful if you could have these neutral procedures. Actually, in the old days, the old left had the idea that we don't need parliaments at all. We're going to have a computer. Everybody's going to put in them their preferences. The computer's going to print out the resolution. And now they forgot that people programmed the computer, but otherwise it was a wonderful idea. Now, I can empathize with this because neutrality is so attractive, especially if it comes out right. But here are two issues. First of all, an empirical question. I am not against deliberative rationality. I just, Charles Lindbom on has shown that every time you look at something the way anybody gets to a resolution, if it's a committee or a country or a community, they cannot come there through deliberate rationality for two reasons. First of all, we cannot separate values from facts like this. They intermush together. So I gave you the other day the example of the deficit. There are a lot of people who are against deficit. Some people are less worried about it. It's not an issue you can resolve on factual basis. There's a moral issue here. The moral issue is what do we owe the next generation? I can take environmental, all the environmental issues have a moral side to them, cannot be resolved on technical grounds. It's a question what we feel we owe to the common good as against our narrow self-interest. So that's simply a technical way. There's no way to resolve these issues because our values are being engaged. So we need moral dialogues to deal with these very differences, like for instance, Gooden did a very nice analysis. What happened when a non-smoker comes to a smoker? The smoker says, I have rights. The non-smoker says, I have rights. Well, now what? And so we need to have, it cannot be resolved on technical grounds. It has to be resolved on the question, which value in this case takes priority and some kind of a pluralism within unity, I would say. But more important is that the procedure is wonderful as long as it doesn't come out wrong. So what we were asking indirectly is about the majority voted for prohibition. So if you go by procedure, we would have to say, the trouble is over. We don't want to take the stakeholders out in favor of a stakeholder approach. But first of all, it entails an enormous shift in our moral judgments because the moment we are told that the corporations belong to those who put up the money, it's theirs. And our whole legal system, and very part of, large part of our ideology, is based on the fact that we accepted this notion that people have private property, and when they give it to the executives to play with, it's still theirs. If you want to come now, just take it for a moment on a corporate level and say that no, the employees and maybe the community, maybe some other groups, each have a say, it's a wonderful industrial democracy. It's a radical change, not in procedure, but in what we value. In my judgment, what we're saying in that case, and I'm very happy to say it, that we value everybody invests in the corporation, including those who invest 20 years of their life, including a community who gave some of our scarce resources. But when Mr. Blair talked about that, he was very careful to say he's not going to legislate it, he's going to look for a change in the ethos of the community. Why? If you could somehow sneak it by parliament tomorrow, what are you going to get? You're going to get everybody going to take their marbles and go to Switzerland or whatever, Singapore, and put their capital there. Well, not everybody, but enough to cause a hell of a problem. If you could convince people of the merit of that, you would be much better off. So in short, even the notion of democracy in the end requires a moral commitment and not just a procedural commitment, because otherwise when it goes in direction on a big thing, which I don't care about, I'm going to find a way out of the procedure. Only if I feel committed to it on a moral ground will I stick with it even when it's painful.
I don't know if anyone would like to take us to the next stage, which in a way would be to be sceptical of this idea that persuasion can really do anything. I'd imagine some of you might think this just sounds weak, soft, avoids the real issues of sort of tough economics and structures and power. Or are you all convinced that essentially persuasion is in fact a very powerful force? At the back there and the front.
My name is Maria Duggan, and I'm here as an individual capacity, but I'm also the policy officer for the Association for Public Health, and thank you for providing me with this opportunity. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm interested in how you translate what you've just said into policy.
and it could be to do with genetics or lifestyle choices, and well, things have very different moral implications.
Well, the study wasn't really designed to answer those questions, and I think we're actually left with a real set of problems. I mean, I think the study set out to look at whether the impact of egalitarian policies made any difference to the to health status. So in particular, the hypothesis that was being tested was whether the Northern European countries and Scandinavia in particular actually had better health statistics than countries in the south of Europe and elsewhere. And in fact, it actually doesn't look as if it makes much difference at all. So one's then left with a question about what causes these differences. And clearly there's a moral set of imperatives here, which is that income inequalities are problematic, health-related inequalities are very problematic, but the two don't necessarily run together, which leaves you with the problem about what the hell to do about it.
So I think I have to bring in Richard Wilkinson here.
Richard Wilkinson, University of Sussex. I was also at that lecture, and while I don't want to turn this into a discussion of the findings of that lecture, I would like to clarify. It was a lecture given by Johan Makenbach in the Netherlands, and he was looking principally at health inequalities in European countries measured by the difference between manual and non-manual death rates, not looking at the rest of the population. He was looking at it also in specific age groups, basically people in their 40s and 50s. The results were very surprising in some of that. Sorry, I didn't have your name.
Maria Duggan from the Association.
Maria Duggan said, because they showed that some of the Scandinavian countries, on some measures, had particularly high health inequalities, measured like that. But one thing that Johan Makenbach, giving the lecture, didn't say, which he had clarified with me in a number of email exchanges, was that actually income inequality was a powerful determinant of the overall mortality levels in the age groups he was looking at. He said there was a 0.9 correlation between the mortality of people in their 40s and 50s and income inequality within that age group. Now, most people find it very hard to think how income inequality can influence the overall levels of mortality in each country without influencing the inequalities in mortality in each country. And I think that what Johan suggested as a resolution of that conflict was that maybe there was very little association between income inequality between non-manual and non-manual groups as a whole and income inequality in the whole of the society. We know that the poor, many of the poor, are outside the labour force, young people, single parent families, some old people and so on. So I think actually it led to people doubting whether the manual, non-manual way of measuring inequality and mortality was a good one, and that presumably one could find income-related inequalities which were more closely related. And indeed, the measures that have been made of inequality and morbidity rather than mortality in relation to income, where you can actually link data for the same individuals, shows again very high correlations. But coming back to Mark's thing, I think there is a very important connection between them, and it takes up, I suppose, your challenge, Jeff, perhaps thinking of more structural things to do with the sort of disagreements and how we resolve the conflicts that Mathieu has been talking about. And my interest is in inequality, which one can measure in a number of different ways. And, you know, I do want to find somewhere in your work more. Perhaps it's there in places I haven't seen, but the brief looks, I haven't found it. Looking at processes which we know power social differentiation in different societies on class lines in terms of material consumption, and the whole range of social values that slot into that, and the social antagonisms between groups, perhaps fueled by senses of injustice and so on, which lead to countercultures and clearly directed social antagonisms, which lead to differences in aesthetic taste, as Bourdieu has shown, and different ideas about child rearing, which link up with all the race and class differentiation. It seems to me that that actually to deal with some of the structural factors which create the problems, many of the problems you're trying to talk about, ways of resolving, must be a central part of any communitarian politics. I'm sure you're aware of the sort of background ideas I'm raising.
Just before you answer that, can I just encourage anyone to come down to the front? There's quite a lot of empty seats here. We'll give you your share of praise if you publicly walk down. No takers at all?
Good stuff. Unhealthy societies, inequality.
Your persuasion failed. Sorry, persuasion failed.
It's compared to what? You could coerce them to come down, I would oppose that. You could pay them, I think it would go broke. And so we'll live in an imperfect world. I will not go into a study I've never seen, which gets to be conflicted here by an expert. But I'll get to the question, I think, which goes into the issue of how we deal with major structural differences which go under the shorthand of inequality. But you start with your question by saying, what would I want the government to do? And that already gives me pause, because one of the things I try to emphasize is that for the last 150 years we locked into this debate between government, private sector, government, and we forgot there's a third sector. And the third sector is terribly important, and it has a lot of merits. It does not mean you want to do away with the other two, and I'll come back to them in a minute. But we have to get off this notion that it's either done privately, or the government does, or it doesn't get done. And so once we start thinking that way, for instance, I understand that before Mrs. Thatcher privatized the waterworks, there was a water shortage. And it was in part dealt with by asking people to use less water, and they're complying with much better than they do these days. There's a model here. We have now in healthcare an attempt to save resources for other purposes by discharging people from hospitals earlier. We can argue about that. In my judgment, certainly the United States has done much too brutally, much too harshly, much too extremely, but we started with people staying 14 days in the hospital for delivery, for normal delivery, then we went to 7, then to 5, and now we're going to 1.5. Okay. Now, by the way, the government stepped in the United States says at least 48 hours. So I'll come back to the bare minimum idea. But one of the issues comes in here, who is going to be there to help? Because a mother already has a child, single, comes home with another child, no way can she handle the situation after 1 or 2 days. Well, again, we can say it's the government's job, we're going to send her a government hired nurse and so on and so on. But we have a whole other bunch of things we want the public to do, and we have a fact in all our societies to a varying degree, a public who is unwilling to pay ever more. Now we can argue exactly how much more and if you explain them better, but in the end there is a limit how much people are willing to send checks to the government, to send a check to their friend to take care of them. So the alternative is, especially for a rising class of senior citizens, they will have to say to them, you live longer lives, you live healthier lives, yes, you worked all your life, but you are the new class of volunteers, we need you. You'll feel better for it and we'll be richer for it. Help us, give us 4 hours a week, give us 6 hours a week, and help us deal with this and other social problems. Now, it's not a solution of everything, but it's one place to go among others. In Germany, they have now parents cooperatives, in which the parents put in 2 hours a week in the childcare center, kindergarten. So there are, I don't want to start each time by sending a message to the government for several reasons I mentioned. Now, next, when it comes to inequality, large time, I'm not talking about playing at the margins, you can, there's a limited number of choices you have, and I really hope we get some discussion on this. We can dream on a fantasy that legislators are going to pass some laws and do away with it, significantly reduce it. It never happened in a democratic society. The other alternative is convince people in a big time that inequality is unjust and the merit of the corrections you want to introduce. How did we get progressive income tax in the first place? How did we get Social Security in the United States? Because it's very limited reallocated power. Precisely because, see, some of you may think there might be one left that socialism is the science of history. For me, socialism is a moral claim. It laid a moral claim on other people, pointing to injustices. And it had about as long like Christianity, forgive me, where the claim had credit is those it's laid on. Moral claims have very little significance if they are aimed at self and nobody else, they don't speak to anybody else. The power of moral claims is a coinage, it's a currency. You lay on others, and if it taps into them, then it has a power. So when we go now to China and say that we abhor what they do to individuals, the reason it's telling, because it upsets them, they get angry, they get defensive, they attack us back. Wonderful signs. If you would go to the Chinese and say that they're ridiculous the way they eat with sticks instead of forks, they would laugh their head off. That is the difference. More claims are telling when they leave their mark. They are the necessary underpinning for major changes. Now, so if you people really care about inequality, and I'm sure like everybody here does, must think about how they're going to make the claim on those people who have to reallocate from to make it happen.
Michael Young, Institute of Community Studies. Following on to some extent what Richard Wilkinson was saying, and you, Professor, in your reply, it seems to me, it must seem to many of us, that the problem we face and the way all societies face, depending on how they divide themselves up in a conventional way into different sectors, the relationship should be between the sectors, in the language we've been using, between the state sector, the government sector, the private sector, and the third sector, as you refer to it as. And I think the thrust of much of the communitarian contribution to the debate about public policy has been stressing the importance of the third sector and the smaller units and the smaller communities, the places which many people feel they belong to, or else they feel they belong to. And what I think has happened in Britain in the last month is a kind of comment on a rather massive scale on the position that's been taken up by yourself and many other people, and perhaps will be again by more people in the future. What we've had, I think, in the many ways of looking at it, is a display of a sort of communitarianism that you probably wouldn't recognize as such on a rather grand scale. The community being the nation, and communitarianism not having that name, but having a rather more old-fashioned name of patriotism. The election of a new government, in my submission, was an extraordinary event, not just because it happened, I mean, some people thought that they were going to have Thatcher and Major and so on forever, but it was extraordinary in the feeling that was aroused, I think, very widely, that here was a new start, and it was a new start on the part of the particular sector which has been so much under attack for such a long time. The government, the state, perhaps only for a short time, maybe only for a honeymoon period, seemed to have a kind of legitimacy and credibility. They certainly hadn't had for 18 years, and perhaps for much longer than that. And showed that there was, what had been, perhaps latent to some extent, was drawn out by this extraordinary event, and people actually seemed to walk around, as been often noticed and commented on before, with smiles where it hadn't been smiles before. They even started talking in magical ways about this way societies work. Test matches, round one, now it's all, I mean, did well in football the other day, whatever. I mean, almost all good and especially unexpected things attributed to be this general mix, which is a new mix of sentiment for the time being, which is all in support of the one bit of these three sectors, the particular sector, which has had a very bad press for a very long time. And to my mind, it does show that there's a very important set of sentiments about the community of the nation which can be drawn out even after the very rough kind of period we've been in. And it is something that's rather like being in a war, but it's in a peace. It's almost as though at least a small battle has been won, and things that were unthinkable some time ago become more or less thinkable, even though people are not quite clear to do with all they could do with all the good feelings and all the new trust that they see welling up and against their better inclinations about the feelings about the government and so on. Something has happened, and it does put a particular point to the very salient questions, I think, about communitarianism, about what is the role of the government in relation to the third sector, what can the great community do to support the small community. If the general thrust of policy is for the government, which has received such an extraordinary vote of confidence, I think, in the feelings of people, if the thrust is to withdraw and cut down on the welfare state and so on, then that's one thing. But if the approach is not that, but rather what can be done to support local communities, which does mean tackling really big problems like inequality and other things, then that becomes the great issue. And I imagine that would become the great issue if you look onto Britain from a little distance. You see that we do have a feeling of new hope. There are many people, not everyone in this room would have thought of it, but many people would, that we are into a new stage of the debate, and it has new angles to it. And I think there are now possibilities, as I see it, of a different kind of, not marriage, interstimulation between the government and the third sector, but based on the government not withdrawing more than a certain amount anyway, say even some few subsets, but really in a very positive way, going out to encourage and support and find all sorts of sustenance for community action at a local level.
Let me just very briefly respond to that, and then I think maybe get at 3-4 questions a bunch. It's common to think about communitarians as being local. I never thought about it that way. I think they are communities, societal communities, the nation's a community. But the question you raise is very much the issue here. Was this a victory of big government? What is the victory of the All Clause 4? Was it a victory of saying, from now on, we're going to go back to relying on the government to do these changes? Or was the victory of a cultural responsibility, of a commitment to get people off welfare, of changing Clause 4 to say a community is where people owe things to one another, and emphasize on the balance between individual rights and responsibilities to the common? After all, it's not an all labor victory. And so the time will tell. It's perfectly possible that the appetite for big government will be reawakened. But I don't think it was the lead theme in the election, and I don't see it as the lead theme in these first weeks. So I very much accept your last point, that there's a need to think about a proper marriage between a third sector and a government which wants to do less so the civil service on most issues, and more so collaboration with the community spread large.
From the Observer. I'd just like to return to this question of equality, because I think there is a...
Can you hear at the back? Could you shout a little bit?
I'd like to return to the issue of equality, because I think there are issues lurking which are more uncomfortable, and which haven't perhaps been quite addressed. The assumption behind the question about inequality was that we all agree that inequalities are a bad thing. And the assumption, I thought, implicit in your reply was that communitarianism basically shares that point of view, and the question only remains as to how you to embody principally, as Michael Lamb has just said, the use of the third sector, the location of common goods within individual communities, then and in individual organisations, the use of the voluntary sector, then it follows that those individual communities and those voluntary groups are not going to be able to provide the kind of standardised pursuit of fairness and fair distribution that is implicit in state provision. And I would have thought it was implicit also in a communitarian point of view that both the politics of left and right have pursued a policy of equality. The left has taken the view that equality can best be pursued through state provision, through equalisation that way. The right, latterly particularly, has pursued the view that equality should be pursued through enabling people to pursue individual choices without anyone saying that individual choices should be considered to be fettered by anything else. Now, I understand that communitarianism is coming along and saying both of those groups have proved in their different ways a bit of a dead end and have actually destroyed important moral virtues and destroyed important aspects of society, hence the need for the third way, the voluntary sector. In other words, there seems to me to be a fundamental, as it were, philosophical contradiction between communitarianism and the pursuit of inequality, which I thought lay behind the question. So perhaps you'd like to address that.
Yeah, but that one deserves a full attention.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay, let me pose it slightly different way. I think some of you might not have heard it. In a way, the question is, first of all, whether equality is really an end in itself, or whether certain moral goals are real ends and equality isn't. There's a second one which you didn't, I think, quite bring out, but maybe in your terms, how much is that a responsibility of the national community rather than being devolved down either to local communities or indeed individual choice?
It's certainly a fair challenge and a terribly important issue, and I'm afraid it's going to take me one extra minute to try even to come to terms with it. In my mind, there is an enormous difference, and it may at first sound technical, but it ain't, between reducing inequality and equality. And that's somebody who spent a year of his life on a kibbutz, so I know what I'm speaking about. The kibbutzim, the Israeli community settlements, in the early days had equality. Everything belonged to the commune. There were no differences other than genetic they couldn't eradicate. And one of the big crises in the days I was there is that somebody in his room had their own coffee mug. And that was considered absolutely scandalous, the intrusion of private property into the perfect equality heaven. What happened in the kibbutz, in the communal settlement, as in any other community, if it's Cuba, Yugoslavia, or Quaker, or whatever, it was unsustainable, for whatever reason I won't go into, and some socioeconomic differences were proven to be essential and really raised their ugly head, if you wish. I would, morally, communitarian or no communitarian, would love a world in which everybody would be equal in every way you can measure it. But it's just... reason been too often covered to go into is just not, it's too elusive to think about. It's not necessary to think about it, because unless we can at least give everybody the basics, we don't have to worry about full equality. So I would like to start, and I have to tie it here to the communitarian message, to reduce inequality to the point where everybody's basics will be covered, and we can talk about exactly what's included, how much. That is communitarian. Because communitarians, first of all, recognize the dignity of all their members, and second, recognize that high level of inequality make for unhealthy communities. They make for stress and conflict. It does not require, a good community does not require, it could aspire, it could dream, it could move toward equality in that leveling sense. But it does need to worry about that the differences between members become extreme or strong to the point that the community will divide itself into the have against the have-nots, the healthy against the sick, and so on and so on. So they put it differently, the basic communitarian idea is based, at least the way I see it, on the basic moral worth of all its members, and that entails ensuring their basics. But there's a world of difference, I don't know if I can find the right words, between leveling everybody so they have the same and saying this is the difference and we have to bring up everybody to here, but we'll talk about the rest later.
What about the level of institutional responsibility? This is a very acute issue in America, in Britain. Is this a responsibility of national governments? Should we think of it as being European, global, local?
The reallocation needs to start at home. The biggest reallocation we're going in through is between men and women in the family. There's a major reallocation taking place. Most of us feel it didn't go far enough, but it surely is where reallocation is starting. Again, I don't need to recite the American history. I'm sure in other countries women could not credit and so on and so on. The second reallocation does occur in local communities, not necessarily residential, where people do care for each other and seek to ensure through informal mechanisms that neighbors will be taken care of. The next level is among communities, among local communities. And there is some measure, though far from sufficient, of inter-community help, where the more affluent communities help the poorest communities. That is often mediated by the state. But there we're going back to the same point. You can have only that much reallocation through the state, the moral dialogue of the community sustained. You see, nobody in the United States, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say nobody, that's a big word. Most Americans are very comfortable with social security. And they're not even particularly mindful that it's a very gentle, very limited reallocation mechanism. They would, again, this is a long discussion, favor basic health insurance for everybody, though, especially if it's got to live in Australia. But they would in no way support major reallocation of wealth, disregarding now what you or she or he thinks is right. The notion that you could come to the United States and take whatever, make a 100% inheritance tax, 50% inheritance tax, or double the progressive income tax, it's just the whole thing's going to blow sky high. Why? Because the moral ground has not been prepared for it. So in the end, what looks like a state mechanism, and there is a state mechanism, it follows terribly tightly, I'm sorry, but it's a fact, the moral sharing of the society as to what it will support and what it will not sustain.
We take a couple of comments on that one there.
I'm still unhappy. The question was asked and mentioned several times. I'm pretty uncomfortable, unhappy with the emphasis on the rather nice and easy sounding charity begins at home idea. With your example there, take the States or take here or take Sweden, people could become ideal communitarians and they could raise the level and so on and just concern themselves with raising the level and doing a great job in their own society. But the same reason, years ago when we had the vote for or against the common market as it was then, and then it was just about a common market, I voted against for that particular reason. Here we were in Europe, relatively rich, lots of wine lakes and green mountains and things. Couldn't we be spending all our time looking after ourselves and forgetting that though all our children go to school and have health and have medicine as they do here, more or less, they're still working at the age of 5 the other side of the world, often for goods that we consume?
Okay, wait a minute. Can we stay with you for a moment? I didn't. Please help me. I didn't understand what you would favor. Would you favor us equally sharing these 5 billion people? Means we will not raise our standards in our family, in our community, or in Britain until we bring on everybody in Africa, everybody in China, everybody in India. We take them all together.
I would say some kind of happy medium. And
what is that?
Say, here's our minimum, let's get there. Well, it's only fair to get a bit further and so on. Only looking inwards and not looking
outwards. I'm sorry, I don't disagree with you, I just want to understand what you're saying. So you're saying we will be doing more for our poor than for their poor, or we won't?
We will be remembering their poor and not putting the emphasis on I must do the best, if you like, for my children and by the best I can,
question of equality and liberty, because I actually think that you need maximum liberty, unconstrained or unqualified by responsibilities, to achieve equality, which is probably slightly different from the utilitarian gender.
Marxism has been evolving a lot here recently.
Well, I'll explain why. And I think as soon as you, in your book, The Spirit of Community, you say that we need a moratorium on rights, and rights should now be...
No, I didn't say that. Find a book.
Rights have to be...
I just want to be clear. I didn't say that. Go ahead. Do your propaganda, but don't lay on me things which are not true.
Rights have to be qualified by responsibilities.
I didn't say that either. Otherwise, you're doing fine.
We need more responsibility.
We sure do.
I think as soon as you
start... need to be responsible critics.
Yeah, I think as soon as you start attaching the question of responsibilities to rights, by which I mean liberties, rights become meaningless. A right with a qualification isn't a right at all. It's a license or it's a privilege. It's like sort of a lifetime constant probation where your liberty is only valid insofar as you act responsibly, and as soon as you step outside responsible behaviour, whoever determines what that behaviour is, your rights are taken away. And you can see that quite clearly in the communitarian agenda of the Crime and Disorder Bill and the idea of youth care groups, which I think you've mentioned in your book, The Spirit of Community, or you proposed it. Alright? And I think that the problem is, so far, the discussion about equality is all about the equality. It's a very limited conception of equality, and it's a conception of equality that's based on distribution alone and outcomes. And I would say that the reason we need maximum liberty, we need free speech, we need freedom of assembly, we need the sphere of freedom, is because there aren't common interests in society. So, you know, to say that you can act in the interest of the community when there is quite clearly a huge conflict of interest, a conflict or a disjuncture of power, which is not at the level of distribution but at the level of production, the labour-capital relationship, is an absolutely massive disjuncture of power. It's a massive conflict of interest. And so anyone acting in the interest of community cannot possibly be acting in the interest of community. Acting in the interest state, and that's ultimately what will happen. The state, in the name of the community, will act in the interests of the establishment.
So you want the maximum freedom, but
we want maximum freedom,
not to property owners, and their rights shouldn't have.
We want the maximum freedom, I think, to struggle, to contest, to conflict, because you're assuming by saying that, you know, there can be a process where you can decide the outcomes in advance. There is no conflict of interest, or that conflict of interest is resolved. I think where if you recognise conflict of interest, you must also have freedom in order for that conflict of interest to be played out.
Okay, is communitarianism suppressing appropriate struggles and battles? Someone at the back there, in the blue?
I wasn't going to address that question, but I wanted to turn to a rather more specific question about public policy. It seems to be one of the questions. The thing we've glossed over is the idea that, you know, there's a certain basic level that everyone should have, and we can debate where that line should be, but that is a matter of public policy which should be addressed. And the problem that I have, or the concern I have, is that when public policy has sought to address the minimum level, the basic level, it has in fact, on some occasions, quite a lot of occasions, actually destroyed the smaller community things that were there before. I know a lot about public housing, and that seems to be an area where that has comprehensively happened. And I suppose my concern is that it's a question, really. Is it possible for public policy to intervene in a sufficiently sensitive way that in its attempt to meet the larger good, it destroys some of the smaller good?
Does anyone else want to comment on that? It was part of Melanie Phillips' question, in a way. Yeah.
If I could have a second bite the cherry. Your question about suppression of conflict.
Well, no, just on
all right.
This issue
no.
First.
Okay.
Well, I think Jeff put the only exactly the question, and it's again a very, very difficult moral issue, and that is, do we have high obligations to what the technical name is particularistic ones, rather than universal obligations? And that's really exactly where the debate is. So on the one hand, we have kind of Kantian notions, that everybody has certain rights. They're citizens of the state of the world, and that's where their legitimacy lies, and we have to conduct ourselves by treating everybody as co-equal, and that's all very strict. Position you kind of are not completely comfortable with. The Comintern position is that we have universal obligations, but we have extra obligations to our particular groups. So when my children, and I'll be absolutely honest about that, my children cry at night, I jump much quicker than when I hear the neighbor's children cry. And everybody else I know feels that way. That doesn't mean it's right, but that's... we have a sense that those who are close to us, our best friends, we owe them more than other people. It doesn't mean we don't owe the others. So that's where the communitarian position comes in. And I do see that we got to hear all of that. I really rather not going to, but I can't justify my position without adding this. Those of you who follow ethics closer know there are basically two camps. One is the utilitarian camp, which explains things by consequences. Often, not all utilitarians are consequentialists, by utilities. And then the ontologist, who sees certain moral causes as this wonderful phrase which the founding fathers of the United States used, a self-evident truth. And there's a limited number of moral causes, which I belong to the second camp, who I believe speak to us in an unmistakable basis, to all of us. And if I have a conversation with somebody, maybe except Marxists, but everybody else, if I can have a long conversation with them, I can make them see the light, that there are certain things, such as the tension between common good and liberty, they can all come to see that. That includes the notion of particular commitments. I believe if we honestly look into each other, at our moral intuitions, each one of our own, that we find it unmistakable that we feel extra commitments, moral commitments, to those who are particular. Now, as to the question of public policy, I think you're right. There is a danger when kind of a Kantian bulldozer comes, that it will erode particular commitments, but it need not be so. We can combine a higher level of commitment, which are particularistic, with a basic, I wouldn't like to use the word minimum, universal commitments. I think we need to treat every human being as have the same basic moral standing. Therefore, I would never accept the line that we have to crack eggs to make omelets when the eggs we refer to are human heads. And so that would be, for me, the absolute minimum. And then we need to realize that certain economic indignities do not make it possible for people to live a fully worthy life. And let me say that the debate beyond that, there are so many people who have never been brought up to the basics. This is really a theological debate in the worst sense, because waving this flag, all it does is slow down getting us to basics. So I would rather not talk for the next 6 years or whatever, 8 or 9, about what complete equality means and how we're going to get there. I would like first to complete this mission of getting everybody in all societies their basics before we can argue how we're going to get there, because this language delays this accomplishment.
Right.
Yeah, well, I think you're correct that we often wait too late to the crisis, but it's really a sad commentary when the only way we can get to re-examine our culture and our moral codes is when they fail us completely. And it's the role of think tanks and intellectuals and public leaders and meetings like this is not to wait till there's a crisis, but to challenge and provoke and push the envelope so we have conversation anticipating things before they happen. And if you give it more time, I would suggest that here and there we have been successful. For instance, at least in the limit mayor, we raised the danger of nuclear war, and I did my small role in that, before we had a major calamity, and so on and so on. So I don't think we always really wait, go to the brink before we have this conversation. But about the what you call an honest discussion, we're serving on a little group with Betty Friedan, who now moved to Washington, D.C., who's trying to build a new coalition to reduce the labor week. She believes that the only way we can resolve many of our problems is if we share work differently. And it's an interesting thesis. As you know, there are some other people in France and otherwise who toy with this idea. The image we came up with is like this. She calls now for a kind of cessation of fire in the war between men and women, because she feels we need at the moment a broader coalition. But out of this discussion came an image which at least I find helpful, and that is how you fight within a community. And here is the way I see it. My analog is when you are in a marriage and there are difference of interest and different values and different needs. Now, when you become aware that you have differences with your partner, it doesn't take long often, you really face a decision. Either you're going to break the union, well then, you know, that's the kind of the class warfare. Or you say, all right, I have a complicated situation here. I want to keep the union, but I also want to change it. And I have to engage in a very peculiar form of fighting for my interests, for my needs, by preserving our community. And when you think about it that way, all kind of very valuable strategies come to mind, which are not only good for resolving issues in marriage, but for the community. And that is, you learn to fight one war at a time. You learn to respect the other without giving up on your interests. There is a whole school of not conflict resolution, of conflict making, which respects that what we share without sacrificing your basic interests and differences. I would apply the same thing to community. We have in the community, there are people, lots of people, who have different interests. And if they feel like feedback might, that this marriage is not going to work for them, they'll have to walk out. And unfortunately, all over the world, in effect, there's a very strong trend of communities breaking out. I think often everybody's better for it if they can follow the marriage model, if they can maintain the union while they're restructuring.
Could we turn in the last few minutes to the question raised earlier, which is about freedoms and some people's view that communitarianism has to be unacceptably restrictive, authoritarian, and trying to hold unions, communities together. Perhaps start with you.
Yes, I mean, coming back to the question that you posed, does communitarianism suppress conflicts? I mean, picking up what the chap did it said from living Marxism, I had some sympathy for his ideas. And what it seems to me is lacking from a communitarian analysis is anything about power, its distribution, its control, and stopping its abuse. I thought it was interesting your analogy about marriage. You don't use any words like negotiation or compromise or contract in the sense of social contract. And going back to what was said quite a long time ago at the beginning about procedures, and it seems to me that there's kind of the implication of your approach is a consensual one. Now, I'm suspicious of consensus, but Middle England, it pretends that there's some homogeneity, and what it might do is it masks differences, and it actually allows for the abuse of power for the most powerful actually to impose their view. I prefer an approach which recognises differences. be happy, but hopefully they'll buy into the process by which that is reached. They might win one time and they'll lose another time. But what worries me, you don't give me any confidence that you will analyse how power is used and therefore that you will protect the victims of abuse of power.
Can I take a few?
I'm quite interested in...
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Ravi. I'm from the Scrutiny Social Policy Group. We're organising a conference soon. I'm just quite interested in what you mean by the third sector and the role of the play in being able to change society. Because it does seem that it's the failure of social engineering to deal with what you call, to deal effectively with what you call the big social problems, not just the margins, but core, difficult social problems. And it's the failure of public policy that means that you have to find some new mechanisms through which you can engender some form of social change. So I can see how you arrive at the need to go beyond the sort of public, sort of private distinction, state versus the market. I can see how you arrive at that conclusion. What I've got more difficulty with is what the meaning of the third sector is in terms of the role it will play, because everything you say seems to be about inculcating individuals with a sense of responsibility for their neighbours and for other members of their community. And it does seem to be a call for self-sacrifice to some extent, that in order for some to benefit, others must sacrifice. And it does seem to me that if we're talking about core social problems, then they're not susceptible to individual sacrifice in that way. They're not susceptible to that kind of moral persuasion where individuals will take some action that will affect these problems. And what I'm curious about is, if it's not about inculcating a sense of moral responsibility to individuals, exactly what is this third sector? Because it doesn't seem to that clear to me, other than an attempt to re-moralise people's behaviour in a more social direction, which I've got problems with the idea that you can make any real social difference by appealing to individuals to act in a more altruistic way.
My position, and I see. I suppose there's one word that I haven't heard today. I suppose, in one sense, I'm glad to mention about globalisation, which is the other thing one stands this theatre talks about. But I do have a problem with the notion of where this negotiation, where this power lies. Because much of the power, and increasingly, seems to lie with those organisations that absented themselves deliberately from being part of negotiation that ordinary people and ordinary communities can engage with by going extra-national, extra-territorial, who have said they would exercise power. And we have the notion of the problems are at level of moral order. Well, I don't have a problem with thinking about morality, but I do have the question about saying, well, where is the power that defines this moral order coming from? Is it coming from those that are relatively powerless? Or is it coming from those who are relatively powerful, have of themselves excluded themselves from a negotiation that I can form part of through any community that I can organise within, or part of, and function. And it seems to me that in trying to empower communities and communitarians and to say there is power within the communities, is to actually absent itself from the main struggle and say the morality is actually very often defined by the powerful, by the transnational companies against the nation state or the participants with it, by white against black, by able against disabled, by rich against poor, and so on. And how do you actually get the sense of agency back within ordinary people within their communities to actually say we have to engage in a struggle which actually relocates that power back to us when the legislative base, when the organisational base is consistently shifted against the freedoms of people who are within Messeret Tierney's communities towards people who are within perhaps Bill Gates or Rupert Murdoch's communities?
Richard, do you want to
say something? Yes, I feel that one can perhaps tie up the two parts of this discussion. I have been concerned with inequality as before, but it seems to me when you had started off talking this afternoon, you talked about the problem of legislation, where there aren't the moral values in the community to support it, and so on. The model your diagram suggests there of inequalities deals with absolute differences. number of people who have talked about the amount of inequality that is tolerated, obviously in terms of saying that perhaps there are quite narrow distinctions between what is tolerated and what isn't in relation to the moral values of not only the society but of the individuals in the situations of disadvantage. You yourself talked about economic indignities, and as you know, poverty is often measured in terms of whether people have or have not got what the majority of the population regard as necessities. There are not only those kinds of indignities and the ones I imagine you were thinking of when you mentioned economic indignities, but there are all sorts of things like what people feel about the role of servants and how people are treated in offices, what a senior person can say to a junior subordinate, what kinds of power, what forms of address, the whole range of moral values that mediate the kind of acceptance or rejection of inequality. And it's surely, and where the issue of power comes in, it's surely when a society does nothing about inequalities that are not tolerated, which are experienced as unjust by the people themselves, which exclude them from any sort of sense of self-worth or belonging to some kind of reciprocal community, of making a contribution and getting a contribution out of it, and clearly unemployment and things like that have that effect on people. But I was surprised that you didn't respond to the questions about inequality in terms of the changing values of society, in terms of the relative inequalities instead of the absolute standards. And I think the same could have been your answer to the things about the international picture in relation to our one here. And of course, sorry, just last point. The big theoretical issue that a number of sociologists have dealt with, including Gary Runciman, who may be here now, is of course why so much inequality is tolerated. The theoretical question of inequality is really is people's tolerance of it, rather than their intolerance of it. It's not the problem one might expect it to.
Since I think he has his hand up, perhaps.
I wanted to come in. I am Gary Runciman. I was going to come in anyway. I don't want to come back to Richard's question. As I'm sure Amitai would agree, sociology, we don't know much. We know some things. And one of the things I think we do know is that the amount, the intensity of conflict does not vary with the degree of inequality in communities of South and Wales. Your example of what happened in the kibbutz when somebody has their own coffee mug, against that, nobody, I don't imagine, in this room or in this country at large cares in the least. Somebody, by pure chance, gets $12 million or pounds because they win a lottery, although measured within the community in which they receive that money, the Gini coefficient goes to the roof, right?
They care if they run the lottery.
What? if you look at the societies across the historical and ethnographic record, all the communities in which a high degree of inequality is tolerated, and if, as somebody I think is accusing you of, you want consensus and you don't like conflict, and therefore that's by implication a good thing to diminish the amount of resentment that people feel once you haven't got the problem of total have-nots, on which I'm sure everybody would agree with you. Then I'd just like to put it to you, isn't it funny that the range of different reasons for which people will accept a surprising degree of inequality, including very often, either on the one hand, though I'd like to come in on the back where I said procedure is important, and again it's a fair division to the economist book, if you, in your community, you the government, can persuade people that the inequalities result from a fair procedure, you're going a long way there. Of course it has to be supported by moral values as well. But the other, to my mind, much more disturbing thing, if you look around the world, is you get small communities with charismatic leaders, and people who will follow them, who will, in a sense, abdicate their own freedom of decision, will surrender their own worldly goods to people who, whether you approve of them or disapprove of them, depends on the end of these communities serve. But it is, to my mind, terrifying just how much influence can be exercised in this sort of travesty of the communitarian ideal, with a highly ideological, highly combative, highly inegalitarian community.
Amitai, a whole series of fundamental questions for you to very briefly give answers to.
But there are already two images and which to the best I can help me think about these issues. One is, there is a world in which there are the powerful and the powerless, and the powerful not only have the power, but they have the moral might. In that world, I basically want to find a white sheet and go to the cemetery, because I don't know what to do in that world. I don't see why the powerful would yield to a fair procedure, especially unless they are unusually stupid. They'll realize that that will mean that sooner or later they'll be taxed or something be taken away from them under this procedure and give to the powerless. So if the powerful have all the power, including the moral might, and the powerless have nothing other than their dreams about conflict, I don't know what to do in that world. I have one news for you, is, and I beg you to pay additional attention to the empirical evidence. The world out there is not made this way. Luckily, the most common way the moral voice is being raised is by the less powerful against the powerful. And that's what Christianity did in Rome, and that's what socialism did when it was had moral force, and that's what all this talk about inequality is, in effect, those who care about the less fortunate lay claims on those who have the power. If they were immune to those claims, we would be back in a world in which the powerful, by definition, are powerful, and they would all run the world. So what happens? Please, look at the facts, because it makes a difference here. Drop this nonsense that the powerful have everything, including the moral might, because by believing that, you delay social change. If you really care about the poor and the downtrodden and the sick and the and injustice, realize that the poverty is not just a statistic. Poverty is a moral claim. We lay on those who are rich, which embarrass them, guilt them, whatever, into agreeing to some reallocation. That doesn't mean you cannot organize the less powerful, that you can employ other means of social change, but there is no reason in the world when you, in addition, can give them the moral cause, that you will rely only on the strikes and boycotts and all those other instruments of industrial strife. So, now, as you suggested, I didn't discuss power. Let me take you back. I talked about difference of interest, difference of values, difference of need, and yes, indeed, there are differences of power. But the critical question for the communitarian exercise is all the might on one side, then how could you get reallocation? Or is there a voice which, to some extent, yes, it is manipulated, it is distorted, but has some independent standing, and that is one lever, not the only one, we can introduce into the dialogue. Let me just say here in closing, for me this was a wonderful discussion. I hate giving lectures. I like to hear from what other people think. That's the way I learn, I grow. And I hope that at least some of you will want to continue this conversation, not tonight, but with each other by joining the communitarian discussion. We by no means have all the answers. We are about 6 years old. Other theories have been, movements have been much longer with us. And keep this dialogue going until we find ever a more compelling communitarian answers. You'll find us on the internet, on the websites and all those good places on the communitarian network. And I hope to hear from you, if not in another meeting like this, in email, faxes, and all the other good ways we can have cross-power communications. Thank you.
Just before you all go and give your appreciation, two small announcements. The next Darwin seminar is in the Old Theatre on the Maladapted Mind on Thursday, the 3rd of July, and I think there's posters on all the seats. And in a flagrant abuse of the chair, there's actually a Demos event here next week on men, the weaker sex, and issues of masculinity, which are an interesting substrand of this debate. But can I thank you all and thank Amitai very much.